Stated if you would shut off your cell phones. And let the record show that present at this meeting are Representative Seaton, Representative Coring, Representative Anderson, and myself, Wilson. And I do want to make comments to the committee and to you in the audience that last week when Dr. Monsager gave his presentation, there were several questions that were asked. He has, I can't believe how fast they got back with those answers, but he has the answers, and so on your desk are the answers to both presentations last week by the department, so I thought that was great. Today, on today's agenda, we have an overview on the children in need of aid, and Marcy Kenai, who is the Deputy Commissioner for the department, and the Office of Children's Services, and Jan Rutherdale. Am I saying that right, Rutherdale? She is the Assistant Attorney General for Human Services. That's part of the Department of the Law. And so if you'd like to come forward and give your presentation, members up here, it's under tab one in your book, and also there is a real nice manual, a Child in Need of Aid manual. So imagine if we just leave this shop until and if they tell us to open it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us today. Jan and I have prepared just a simple presentation on children in need of assistance and how children come into care and how the Office of Children's Services responds to those children in need. So I guess with that, Jan and I are going to go through the flow charts. Seems like the simplest way to begin.
All right.
And if you have any questions, we'll be glad to respond.
And that's under tab one of your book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Essentially, the Office of Children's Services is basically an agency that intervenes. Our prevention services tend to be limited. They are in other parts of the child, in other parts of the system, in public health. Some with us in the Women, Infant, and Children's Nutrition Program is certainly prevention, and our Healthy Families Alaska program. But for the most part, OCS does not get involved in a family's life unless we receive a report of harm. And so that's really where we begin, when the community or a mandated reporter, teacher, a doctor, someone that's defined in statute as a mandated reporter, would report to us that a child is being harmed. So we receive those reports in every office throughout the state, and we have 28 offices right now throughout the state, throughout the state of Alaska. Once we get a report, and they usually come into us by phone, once we get a report, the person who answers the phone would ask a series of questions. We do use some screening tools to determine how serious a report might or might not be. But we try to gather as much information as we can from the reporter. Any reporter can remain anonymous or can give his or her name. That's the choice of the person who is reporting to us. So that's what we call kind of the screening process. That is, we get the report, we try to gather information over the phone from the reporter, and then we make a decision as to whether or not the facts would require an investigation. That is, whether or not there is enough information for us actually to go out and intervene in the family's life. We determine how quickly we will investigate in accordance with some priorities. So by asking this series of questions, and we call this kind of a structured decision-making tool, which is an actuarial-based tool that is used nationally. So we ask some questions, and basically it's a flowchart like this that takes us to certain decisions or helps us to make those decisions. Of course, we can override that if our intuition tells us that something is going on and the tool leads us to a lower priority than we think it should be. But essentially, we have three priorities. Our highest priority, that is, if the reporter indicates that there are enough facts, that this seems like an emergency, we will prioritize that as a priority one referral. That means we need to be out into that home or seeing that child within 24 hours. Priority two, we need to be out within, within 72 hours, I'm sorry, within 72 hours, and our lower level of reports, we would need to be out there within 7 days. We go out, we investigate. Sometimes we see the child at school. Sometimes we see the child in another provider's home or a child care home. But we do lay eyes on the child. We would then interview the parents, other collaterals, anyone else that we have information, that might have information about the case. And then we make a decision as to whether or not this child can be served or whether or not the report is actually substantiated or not substantiated. Throughout the course of the investigation, if we feel that the child is in danger or in a situation where there might be imminent harm, we can take emergency custody. We need to be in court within 24 hours, Jan?
48 hours of filing a petition.
Within 48 hours of filing a petition. So we file the petition within 24 hours, and we need to be in court within 48 hours. And so there are some checks and balances in the system that OCS might file a petition and intervene, but the court, you know, the court will hear the facts surrounding the case to determine if OCS should continue to have custody. Of course, some of those investigations result in unsubstantiations or the case not being substantiated. We can then refer the family for services if we think they're at risk. We do contract with providers in a variety of communities for family preservation services. So families who have some risk but who do not rise to the level where the children need removal would be referred for those community-based services. At this point, I'm going to turn to Jan and see if there are any legal... you want to talk a little bit about the temporary custody hearing?
Sure. First, I wanted to introduce myself. I'm Jan Rutherdale from the Attorney General's Office. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I'm in the Human Services section, which statewide has 24 attorneys, and we represent the Department of Health and Social Services. And of those 24 attorneys, about 19 work on child and youth aid cases, so it's really the bulk of our Human Services section. And we have offices in Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, and then we fly out to, also Bethel and Nome, and we fly out to other communities to provide legal services there. So we start working with the Office of Children's Services well before the petition is filed. A social worker will call and say, I have a case. You know, here are the facts. Do I have enough to go forward or not? You know, so we'll provide legal advice for that. And once a petition is filed, there's two types of petitions. There's the emergency and non-emergency. As Ms. Marcy said, an emergency is filed within 24 hours of the emergency custody being taken. And there are certain grounds for taking emergency custody. It has to be very serious reasons for taking the child before actually going to court. For non-emergency petitions, obviously, we go to court first, ask for custody to be taken, and then it's up to the court. And so it gives us the power to protect the child when that needs to happen, but it also requires us to get into court very quickly, within 48 hours, 2 days, so that the evidence can be tested. And that's done at the temporary custody hearing, the initial hearing. And at that point, there's two things that the state has to prove in order to, at that hearing. One is that there's probable cause for the child is a child in need of aid. It's a low standard. It's it's not preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard at trial.
Could you just go back a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
And give us an example of what would be an emergency and what wouldn't be, and then as you go along, kind of bring one of those examples with you so that we can kind of understand it a little better.
Sure. That's it. Interrupt me anytime. An example of emergency custody is if the child has been subject to physical abuse and his injuries are such that they're life-threatening or requires immediate medical attention. You know, you can't wait for that. Sometimes for a non-emergency petition, you know, depending on the court's calendar, it could be a week or two before going to court. So that would be an example. The kid's bleeding and needs to be taken into the hospital. The parents refusing or not capable of or whatever. But basically, right now the way the statute's written, if the child's been abandoned, you know, there's nobody around to care for the child. If the child has child or a sibling has suffered sexual abuse. If the child has been neglected or physically damaged, and that high standard of immediate medical attention or life-threatening situation exists, that's basically the basis for emergency custody. When I say that they have to show by probable cause that the child need of aid, 4710.011 lays out the bases for us to go to court, because we can't, meddle in these people's lives unless we can fit the facts within about, I think there's about 12 subsections in that. And the most usual times you have is neglect. The child's failing to provide the child's physical needs. Housing, failure to provide housing, clothing, food, shelter, medical attention, or the necessary supervision that's necessary for the child. Another typical ground is physical. The child is has been physically abused or is at substantial risk of physical abuse, and that would be obviously harming the child that's beyond parental spanking or something that is sanctioned by the society. Striking the child, other parts of their body, leaving welts. But of course, the social worker has to look at all the surrounding circumstances to see if is this physical abuse? Is this required to go into court immediately? I mean, they're constantly evaluating. Is this really serious? Do we need to go and get a formal petition before the court, or can we work with the family? Sometimes parents lose it and they mistreat a child, but they're so remorseful and, I'll do anything. I realize I don't have good parenting techniques, just let me work with you. And we would never, OCS would never, it wouldn't even get to the court. It wouldn't even get to our office with a phone call. It would be obvious. Sexual abuse. But a non-emergency, even though we have the power to take emergency custody in a sexual abuse case, and we don't have to show life-threatening or anything like that, if the abuser is out of the home and the responsible parent is being responsible and protecting the child, you don't want to further victimize the child from removing the child from the home. And again, maybe the services can be provided to the child. Maybe the child will need counseling, that sort of thing. And there's no need to go into court.
Just a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative
Gardner
has a question. And before we go any further, I'd let the record show that Representative Cisna and Representative McGuire have joined us. Representative Gardner,
thank you.
Go ahead.
Are there circumstances in which the state would move to take custody of a child without removing
yes.
from the home?
Yes. Okay.
And that leads into my next, there's two things that needs to be shown at this hearing. One, is there probable cause? You know, is there enough evidence to keep the state temporarily involved in this child's lives pending the next court hearing? And secondly, does this child need to be removed from the home? Sometimes the state won't even ask for removal. They'll just say, you know what, we just want to formally work with these family and get supervision. We don't feel there's a need to remove the child from the home, but we want to supervise. We want to make sure that the parent is going to the necessary parenting classes or substance abuse treatment, but we don't feel it's necessary to remove the child from the home. If the state is asking to remove the child from the home, they need to show that it's contrary to the welfare of the child to remain in the home. And, then in Indian Child Welfare Act cases, there's a higher standard, clear and convincing evidence that the child would be at a risk of substantial physical or emotional damage to remain in the home. And I think as a practical matter, I think what the Indian Child Welfare Act is, it's raised the bar for all cases. I mean, I think the court is so used to looking at that standard that pretty much that's the standard that governs. So the court, sometimes the state will ask for removal and the judge will say, you haven't met that burden. We think it's appropriate that the child remains in the home.
Okay, Representative McGuire has a question.
My apologies through the chair. On that point, are you saying that because the courts have become so accustomed to using the higher clear and convincing standard of ICWA, that now in point of fact they apply that higher standard to all cases where child removal
That's my belief, but I only practice in Juneau. I've been practicing in this field for about 17 or 18 years. So I feel confident saying that in Juneau, and I can't speak for the rest of the state.
And then just in follow-up, one of the things we're looking at as a legislature, you probably know there are various bills in the works looking at some fundamental changes to child need of aid. Laws, is that a recommendation that you would make to this legislature to change the statute formally to require that higher standard that is similar to the ICWA standard?
That's not a bill it's not being proposed, and I don't have any position about that. I think the system is working fine. I think the courts, contrary to the welfare of the child, I think the best interest of the child is probably the lowest standard, and then contrary to the welfare, I mean, it's kind of hard to define what does that mean, but it's something more than just what's in the best interest. It's not what's best for the child, it'd be contrary to the welfare of the child to remain in the home. So I think it's a standard that is pretty high, and I think when the courts look at what is contrary to the welfare mean, I think they will look to the Indian Child Welfare Act for guidance.
Okay.
I know in Juneau, simply as a practical matter, a large proportion of our cases are Indian Child Welfare Act because either one or both parents make the child eligible.
Representative
Thien?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. The standard that's used for that determination, is that a community standard or is that a statewide standard? I mean, if we get into a situation where we have rural, no electricity in the home, those kind of things, is this applied as a community standard?
Absolutely. And the Indian Child Welfare Act is a good guidance for that because they say you can't remove, you have to look to the community norms. And so in the case of a native village, maybe their tribal practices have been to have large extended families taking care of the children and, you know, lots of people living in one house. And that's why the Indian Child Welfare Act was established in the first place, to say that's, you know, you can't oppose your white middle-class social work values on the Native people. But I think that would go for anything. Obviously, if a community doesn't have electricity, and I think it says that for neglect, you're failing to provide the physical needs, and if there's no electricity, but the children are not cold because there's fire, you know, there's warmth. They're not, you know, they're not living in a van when it's, you know, negative 42 and they're coming to school sick all the time, you know, then the parents are fighting for them.
Thank you.
Is there a point at which you want to go back? Or?
I guess
what I'll just say is once probable cause is found and the temporary custody, either temporary custody or temporary supervision is granted, the court has to set an adjudication hearing within 120 days. And the adjudication is the trial, is the child a child in need of aid? And so there's a up to three-month time period where the case will be in a temporary custody status. And I don't know if you want to talk about what happens during that time.
During that time that we have temporary custody, we begin working with the family around developing a permanency plan for the child. And of course, first we try to make sure that we have looked for relatives and family members to take care of the child, because that generally, if the parent cannot care for the child, the next best thing for a child is a family member. If we can't find a family member, then we certainly look to a foster home for placement. And as the child remains in care, we need to look at whether or not the parent will have the capacity to actually engage in a planning process with us to seek services, to ameliorate whatever the neglect or abuse or whatever the situation that brought the child into care, to ameliorate that, and that's really the intent. So during the first 3 months, we work with the family to develop a plan of services that we give and some roles and responsibilities for the parent himself or herself. So that at the time we go back into court, we can say the parent is moving forward. We feel we need to keep the child in custody a little bit longer until the parent is able to achieve, you know, their goals. Yes, I'm sorry.
Representative, through the chair.
Yes, I was curious. We have I guess that's statutory limit, 120 days. With caseloads and everything else, how are those working out? I mean, are we working within 120 days, or do we fall outside of that? Any cases with the number of caseloads?
Go ahead, do you want to answer? I think the court is used to that time frame for criminal cases, and so I think they will always set it within that 120 days. In some places, it may be sooner than that. So I don't think that's a problem. Now, you know, it may not be enough time to get the family where they need to go within that period. Right. I mean, but that sort of work goes on whether or not that we're past the adjudication stage or not.
So on this matrix that we're looking at, where are we at right now? We're right between the temporary custody hearing.
Yeah, probable cause exists, that box. We're beyond that.
Okay.
And basically, in this diagram, everything to the right is when, you know, the family leaves the system. So it's really, we're assuming, as we discussed, this is kind of like worst case scenarios. I mean, the ones where we're continuing to go on and on and on. But at any point, the hope is, and this is often what happens, is the family will leave the system because things are improving in the home.
Follow up. As we're going through these, if there are any of those timetables, the 24 hours or the 48 hours that we're not being able to meet because of whatever circumstances, caseloads, et cetera, would you be sure to let us know that that isn't being filled.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll assume that all those timetables are working.
And through the chair, Representative Seaton, sometimes that does depend on the jurisdiction, I would think. Some courts are able to schedule things in a timely way all the time, and some of the courts are not. And so it's not only OCS caseloads, but the court's caseloads, the Attorney General's caseloads, and a lot of other things that are outside of our control that tend to be unique to a particular region or office.
Madam Chair, and follow up, yeah, I guess that's what I was wanting to establish, is to find out if we do have particular jurisdictions or particular bottlenecks where we're not being able to follow the timelines that are mandated. So if you would point those out, I'd appreciate them. And you can follow up in writing if there's particular.
Okay. So as I said, we begin to work on what we call a permanent plan or a permanent planning goal with the parent and with the children when they are first placed with us. We not only establish what is the best placement for the child, but what is the long-term goal going to be? And we generally begin with a goal of reunification. And the majority of our children do go back to their parents. And a little bit later, I'm going to refer you to some of the charts I've given you, and you will see that the preponderance, almost 60% of our cases, do go home. But sometimes that takes work, and it does take time, and it's a matter of, are services available in a particular community? Are we able to, or will the parent avail themselves of those services? So that and family visits continue during the time the child is in custody. We are always making reunification efforts. The law requires us, at a point a child is with us 15 out of the last 22 months, the federal law does require us to look at a plan of adoption or to change a plan to adoption if a parent has not been successful in that amount of time. Now, that can be overridden if we have reasonable cause to believe that the parent just needs a few more months, but they are succeeding in treatment. We can go to court, and the court can say to us, you don't have to change the permanency plan, or by federal law, we don't have to change the permanency plan to adoption. But as we move forward, you know, and the sad thing is that so many of the children come to us because of a parent's addiction either to alcohol or to drugs or to some other substance or even mental illness. Parents may try to get services, but we know that it takes anywhere from 7 to 9 attempts in treatment to really for a parent to actually recover or fully recover or become or not be using anymore on a permanent basis, and that's, you know, for a child, the child sense of time. We can often not wait years and years while a parent, you know, is moving on their 7th, 8th, or 9th attempt. And so we do have to make some very difficult decisions sometimes about moving toward termination of parental rights at the 15th month. That's probably the most difficult decision for our staff, and I know for the judges that are involved, it's also a very difficult decision for the judges. At the 12th month, we do go back to court, and the court does review our permanency plan. And so the progress that we are making is reviewed again by the court at 12 months. And internally, we have an internal administrative review, which is also required by federal law, where we are reviewing the permanency plan at the 6th month. So every 6 months, for all intents and purposes, someone is objectively looking at our work and at the parents' efforts to see whether or not this child is lingering in care or whether there's movement and progress toward permanency planning for the child or toward achieving the permanent goal for the child. So balancing the child's sense of time and the child's need for a permanent placement and looking at the parents who we know are trying very hard but who may be addicted and suffering from that disease of addiction, It's often a conflict, and a very real conflict. For our social workers, it often causes what causes burnout. I mean, we talk about high caseloads, but I think we also need to talk about just the difficulty of the work and making those difficult decisions on a daily basis. So I just wanted to point that out, because I do think that caseloads are a big piece of what we do or what we don't do, or what we're not able to do sometimes, but our vacancy and our turnover rates are often created by things other than high caseloads as well. Just the difficult nature of removing children from their families or making the decision to terminate parental rights is just a tremendous heart-wrenching decision for us.
Ms. Can I tell me this? Do you have parents that have tried to go through the treatment and they just can't get a handle on it and everything? At 12 months or 15 months, do you have them panicking and just wanting to get up and leave so that you guys don't come in? I mean, how often does that happen, or does it happen?
Madam Chair, I believe it happens fairly frequently. I think especially when you get to the 15th month, you may have parents who've been trying all along, whether they've been half-hearted attempts or three-quarter attempts. At the point you say, we must go forward with termination because there's been no progress, that is sometimes when they will move forward. Unfortunately for the child, they have A, bonded in the relative or the foster home. We have a track record now of a parent having tried six or seven times, three or four times even, and not having succeeded, and so we have to make a decision based on the parent's history. We like to see a parent sober or clean, if it's the case of drugs, for at least 6 months. It's not set in stone, but certainly if somebody has been addicted for a number of years, we would want to see, you know, a track record. We do give parents a lot of opportunities. Again, I think sometimes it's resources are not out there for them, especially in the remote areas of Alaska. It's much more difficult to find services, and it does sometimes take us longer to get a parent into treatment because we have to bring them to Anchorage or to Fairbanks or to one of the areas where there are resources. So those factors are taken into consideration. If we really believe that it's our fault or that the parent has not been able to avail themselves of services, we present that to the court as evidence that maybe we should not be terminating at 15 months. So again, these checks and balances in the system, I think, are really important. If we have a worker who's overzealous, I think the court will slow us down. So our 6 month and our 12 month reviews, I think, are very important because it checks our progress and it checks the parent's progress. So the parent has to say to the administrative reviewer or to the court at 12 months, I'm succeeding or I'm not succeeding. The court can then admonish the parent, and it's not just us.
Yep. So what can you do as far as if the coming up on the 15th month, the parent knows that, and so the parent, you know, will just freak out, pick up the kids and go. Now, where does your authority continue, or if they leave state, is it gone? I mean, what happens?
Well, I think I can answer that. Mm-hmm. If we have custody, that means that, you know, the state is in effect the custodial parent, and as with all custodial parents, if the non-custodial parent or, you know, someone else removes the child from the jurisdiction against an order of the court, it's a criminal offense.
Is that kidnapping?
It's not kidnapping, but it's custodial interference in the first degree leave, which is a felony if you leave the state. It's a misdemeanor if you don't leave the state. So to answer your question, we can, first, the parent could be subject to criminal prosecution, but also we can just, you know, have the police go get them and bring them back.
Now, are they, I mean, is it laid out to them, now, well, we have custody of your children, even though they're with you, mm-hmm. you can't do these certain things.
Right. Is that? Well, and it's, if,
There are times we could have, that we could actually have full custody, and we choose to place the child in the home, the parent's making progress, and, you know, it can be called a trial home visit, or other times, we've never actually gotten full custody. We have supervision, but it's implied that supervision is granted on the presumption that the parent is cooperatively working with the state. If I were worried that a parent might leave, I would get a specific court order that they're not to leave town. Otherwise, there may not be a specific order, but it wouldn't look good for them. As a practical matter, though, there are several types of parents. There are the ones that are really trying and working, and those are the ones we like, you know, and things are moving in their favor. There are the ones that, for whatever reason, addiction or, you know, they were abused at their child. They have a lot of mental health issues, really, at that point to work through. They just can't get it together, and they know it at some level. And at the 12 months, when we go back to court, they know where they're going with this case, and there isn't a whole lot of, it's not scoop the kids and run, it's you know, acquiesce or give up or go on a drunk or whatever. But I think I wanted to back up a little bit, and I guess I've been doing this long enough that there's the pendulum over the years has swung back and forth. And
yes, I agree.
Yeah, and you've seen it too. And before I started working, there was a push to almost reunify at all costs. And the problem with that is no one was ever saying, are we ever going to get these kids home? And it was called foster care drift. You know, the kids were growing up in foster care. And unfortunately, some of the parents we're seeing today are the ones that were brought up under that system. And they're, you know, we'd like to break that cycle because they haven't had a good home life and haven't felt that sense of permanency. And so that's the federal government, through the Adoption and Safe Families Act in 1997, said, wait a minute, you know, parents have rights, but there's a point at which there's a time limit. They don't have rights forever, and we have to look and make sure that these kids are getting a permanent home. And that's why the new law, well, new as of 1998 in Alaska, says let's just stop and look at the case at the 12-month level and see where we're going. And at the 12-month level, we don't have to terminate, and often we don't. And there, it says as long as the Division of Health and Office of Children's Services can document a compelling reason for not moving forward with termination, and they have a list of what those compelling reasons would be, and that would include, you know, obvious ones like the kid's 16 years old. You know, and really the permanent plan is emancipation or, you know, getting them enough services so that when they turn 18 they can go forth in the world. Or there may be the child has such significant issues themselves that they just aren't adoptable and nobody wants to make orphans out of them. I mean, the whole point of terminating parental rights is to free them for adoption. And so we don't want to just terminate parental rights just for the sake of it. But another, you know, really main one is we don't terminate because the parents are showing progress. And maybe it'll take them a little longer, but that's okay. They're moving in the right direction. And I've had cases where we've gone in at 12 months and said, you know, they're making progress, but we're just not sure it's going to work. And or they're not making progress. And we go and file a termination petition within the next few months. And set the trial for, say, 3 months. So now 6 months have gone by. And during those 6 months, the whole process of saying, it's not working, we're going to terminate, has galvanized the parent. And they suddenly turn around, and we go into court and say, we're dismissing the termination petition, we're placing the children back. So I think it's good because it it's a wake-up call to the parents to say, we can't wait forever for these kids. You do it now or not ever.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been a contract guardian ad litem for some years and do have some experience with this. And some of the issues that have been raised here today were always of concern to me. First of all, the issue of visitation. And just to assure Madam Chair that a lot of times if parents are not making progress, they don't have the opportunity to snatch kids because they have supervised visits. They don't have the kids come home. And if they're in treatment and doing well, then there's a gradual reintroduction of the kids might go for a visit and maybe spend the night and then build up over time. So if they're at the one-year time or 15 months, it's unlikely the parents have that kind of access that would allow them to. But one of my concerns was that when a child comes into custody and is removed, you may have parents who have been using substances or whatever, but kind of trying to keep a lid on it. And you remove the kids, and it's like their last thing that prevents them from just falling off the deep end. And we saw this over and over again, I'm sure you do too, where they just totally disappear. They're not even available for visits. You don't see them or hear from them until they kind of, at some point, either hit bottom and say, I got to do something, or they're just gone. And when the petition for termination is filed, and then they'll often come around and go, whoa, I got to do something here. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it's a temporary thing. It's just what the cases I was involved in, we often did is just kind of postpone the hearing for 6 weeks. In 6 weeks, you'll have a real good idea, parents still in treatment, or parents disappeared again, and you haven't lost the work that's already been done. But one of my concerns was when parents were available for visits, and especially early on in the case when the visits have to be supervised, and it's so important, particularly with younger children, to maintain contact with parents. It's been very, very difficult because you don't have the resources to supervise them. I don't know what it's like in Juneau, but in Anchorage, the visitation area is just unacceptable, and it doesn't promote any kind of interaction between parents. It's kind of sterile. You hear phones and people coming in and out and interruptions and this and that, and that's always been a concern. There were agencies like, I believe CITC does child visitation. Is that going well? Is there need for more of that? Facilities where parents can interact in a healthy way with children, where the children are still safe, but they're not being interrupted and visibly monitored.
I think in Juneau or Southeast, and maybe Marcy can speak for the rest of the city, but it's not so much, I think it's fairly easy to find a place. I mean, the little visitation room at the Office of Children's Services, you know, the staff office in Juneau may not be that great. But I mean, it's got toys and that sort of thing, but still you're in an office setting. There are other settings that are around town that can offer a more home-like setting. But I think it's exactly what you said. It's the lack of resources to actually supervise. So you need people, not just places, but actual people to sit there. And I think, you know, without the visitation, you're going to lose that bonding attachment. The parent may not see if they keep seeing the child, they may say, oh yeah, this is why I'm going to treatment. So I think that's a huge problem. And with cutbacks, I mean, look, for example, the OCS offices locally, the social workers would do it if they could, if they had time, but there was a grant to contract out for, I think, Catholic Community Services to do that. And I know, and maybe through cutbacks or other reasons, you know, that there's less, you know, less personnel for that now.
Okay. And then one follow-up?
Follow-up.
What would you say is the average amount of time, say, in the first month of out-of-home placement, how often do children get to see their parents?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I guess I would have to say not often enough. We know this is an issue, and it was certainly when the federal when the feds came here and reviewed Alaska's system, visitation was a big issue for us. It was an issue that we were not doing well with. So we are trying a lot harder now. I think we are getting better, but certainly not enough. What I would like to tell you is that there is some very exciting work going on in Anchorage, and we will begin to spread this around the rest of the state as soon as we can. But we are beginning to work with foster parents differently. We will begin to recruit them differently, and we will begin to redefine their role. And one of their roles will be to supervise visits between Wow. parents and children. And at this particular time, the way we currently work with foster parents, we really don't have those expectations. And so we are moving forward. We have a demonstration project in Anchorage called Family to Family. It is funded by the Rasmussen Foundation, and we receive a lot of technical assistance from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. But it is changing the way we work, and we're beginning to see some wonderful results in Anchorage. And so we're going to kind of redefine our recruitment message as we begin to go out and look for foster parents. We will say this is an expectation because we do believe that that is part of their responsibility. In addition to that, we do, as Jan said, have some supervised visitation contracts around the state. We can certainly find out where they are. I don't know offhand, but I think that's one of the things that we can, you know, we can get to you. But supervised visitation is only necessary when we really think the parent is a danger. We should have opportunities to visit the children or to allow the biological parent to visit in the foster home or take them on a lunch. We are required ourselves to visit every child every month. We are required by federal law to make sure that the parents and the child are visiting every month. And so we need to meet our own requirements and our own policy. Some of this is due to caseload and our own lack of resources and the ability of workers to have the time to do that. I do believe, and I thank all of you who were here last session for giving us 26 new positions, because that has made a big difference in our ability to move forward and to make these things happen. And they are in the child's best interest.
Ms. Kanai, you said, when she asked the question, how many times are they visiting, you said not enough. Tell me how much is enough.
Well, during the first month, I would think at least two visits. The requirement is one. The requirement is one a month. But I believe, as you do, that weekly visits are not too much, especially in the beginning. Keeps a parent motivated. You know, and especially at the beginning, when the best time to motivate a parent is either at that serious point of termination or at the very first, you know, at the very first crisis, which is when the child comes into care, when the child is removed from the home.
Because I'm just thinking, me as a parent, if that happened to me, I mean, you know, once a week probably wouldn't be enough. I mean, you know,
sure.
So it's really tough to think that maybe sometimes they're only getting, not thinking of the parent, but as the child, they're being ripped out of their home, mm-hmm. and they're with somebody else that they don't even know yet, and it might be a month before they get to see their parent.
I guess I could speak through, I don't know about the rest of the state, but I'm, even though the federal government says, you know, this is the minimums, my experience is, it runs the whole gamut. But if you had a new the social worker would try to, you know, sometimes up to 5 hours a day. I mean, you know, because it's such a crucial bonding period. Others have said daily contact, either through telephone, depending on the age of the child,
right.
of course.
And the location,
right. Others think of creative examples, like through relatives. You know, often there's the mm-hmm. grandparent. Maybe the child's with the grandparent, and so it's very natural, and the child will be in and out. There's one case where there's three children in a foster home, and the mother sometimes comes home over every single evening. It's basically with the children from 5 to 8. That's very unusual. Foster homes, I mean, don't usually open their house. I mean, in fact, a recent snowstorm, she just moved in for the weekend and was there with the children. But I think, you know, not all cases can be like that. And but certainly, one thing I guess I want to say is at the first time we're in court,
that's the time the court is going to either, well, that's the time the court's going to appoint an attorney or the parents are going to bring in an attorney. It's a practical matter. Most of our clients, the parents can't afford attorneys, and so they're appointed. And it is an adversarial system, and part of that checks and balances is if the parent is not seeing their child enough, and you know, they can go back to court and say, this is crazy. And I think the judges will say more like you, well, at least twice a week this should be happening. And even though resources are slim, if it needs to be supervised, to have a social worker or a contractee to do it, they try to get creative and come up with anyone that is responsible to supervise a visit. You know, sometimes it's the CASA or the court-appointed special advocate or the guardian ad litem. Although that's again depending. Yeah, there's
tribal workers.
There's tribal workers. There's in Juneau. There's a little house. It's kind of homey, and they'll have visits there. So there are other alternatives out there. But I agree. It once or twice a month is not enough. And I don't. I would hope that that's not acceptable.
Representative Sisson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Vice Commissioner. Commissioner. Well,
just call me Marcy.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've heard from the CASA worker, so now we have to hear from the former foster parent and actually supervised a therapeutic foster care program in Fairbanks as well. So I've seen it from several different sides, and from the foster parent side, and unless it's changed, and it would have had to have changed dramatically in the last year. What I have seen is an amazing turnover in foster parents. When I was a foster parent, I only would take one child at a time, and I would get weekly calls begging me to take more. And I didn't, because I knew I would do a better job if I only had one at a time. And as a member of the Foster Parent Association, heard a lot of stories about exactly the same thing. Oftentimes, if families are really, if they could really benefit by having more kids, and sometimes that will happen, and sometimes that's a wonderful thing because they're natural, they were born to be parents, and they're great parents of multiple kids. Too many times, those are parents that maybe don't have another parent in the house. It's one person, and so you wind up with a lot of kids, the maximum in a home that where you just don't get the kind of parental coverage. And we've had this discussion before, but I'm going to say it again. That's where the real rub occurs here, where if in fact we're taking children away from homes because we're putting them in better homes and we're providing them with stability and they're in a placement that they will stay in until there's either reunification or they go back to or they go to an adoptive home, then that's the best we can do. But if in fact they go to a home where there's abuse, there's re-abuse, and a lot of times it's the kids against the kids when you've got too many kids in a home, then I think we're doing there's a moral question here. And I know that I keep an eye every month on the numbers of kids in foster care or the number of kids in the system, and it's maybe gone down by 10 or something like that in the last year. It's not very much. And so, and that relationship between the state and the foster parents is a critical thing, and it has not been good. There has not been the kind of support that there needs to be, and it's not necessarily financial. It's sometimes just having somebody to call that can walk you through really, really rough times. I'm just wondering what's happening. I know you're doing a pilot program, and that's wonderful. what's happening to the rest of the foster parents out there? What kind of turnover are we having with the kids in the home?
Through the chair, Representative Sisson, I don't have turnover figures for you today. We can get that. But I can tell you that a major part of our system reform that is going on is working with foster parents. It's that whole foster parent piece. You know, we're changing the way we license foster parents so that we put intense home studies up front. And you and I think, have talked about this in the past, but what right now we do kind of a cursory home study on foster parents. People who come to apply to us to be a foster parent meet certain standards that are set forth in statute and policy, and then they are licensed if they meet those standards. Most of our adoptions take place are foster parents who are adopting the children in their homes. At the point they request to adopt, we do a thorough home study, a thorough family assessment. We are moving that process to the front end so that starting in February, where we will begin in Anchorage, and we can only begin in Anchorage, again, because of staff resources, but we will begin to do intense home studies. In addition to looking at whether a home meets standards, we'll begin to really do a family assessment. We've had all our licensing workers trained about 2 weeks ago. We had some expert consultants come in to train all of our licensing workers on how you do a family assessment, because right now they're not doing them. And so this will change moving forward. The other thing we are changing is that we will have two types of workers. We'll have the worker who actually does the home study and the licensing, and then we will have family support workers, foster family, or what we're calling resource family support workers. And so that is part of the budget package. In the positions that I have requested 10 new what I call foster parent staff or foster resource family staff, so that we will be able to have workers who do nothing but have the time to chat, to visit at least monthly every foster parent. That is, it doesn't matter if you have a child in the home, you may be between children, but you still have some things you need to talk about or improve upon, some training needs, whatever it is. So we will be creating that staff.
Thank you. That sounds like we have slipped back then, because in the late 1980s was when I came into the system, and I was required to take, I think it was an 8-week training, essentially. Mm-hmm. Had to have a home study, had to have all of those things in place, and then had annual training that we had to keep up as well. That doesn't sound like it's there now?
Through the chair, Representative Sisson, we still have required training for all foster parents. Okay. Our home studies are generally done in one visit, and it really does revolve around standards and some very some standard kinds of questions. It's not really an assessment. For example, we're not really asking, well, how, if a child is, if you're taking unrelated children into your home, how is this going to affect your marriage, your children, and how many children can you realistically care for, and you know, what will you do if this happens or if that happens? How were you disciplined as a child, and will that affect how you discipline foster children? So I'm not saying that some of this isn't going on, but it's not our standard practice. When I pick up a licensing file, I know that the family has met certain standards, but I don't really know the family. Now I'm going to be able to pick up a licensing file, and I'm going to see a complete family assessment. And those, you know, we hope that those will be able to maintain those as confidential. It probably will require 3 visits to a home. We will want to meet every member of the home. We will want to talk to the mother and the father and the children together, and then we may want to have some conversations with them alone. Right now, we are not able to do that. We're not really able to do a thorough assessment. I do believe in the world of therapeutic foster care that is done. upfront. And that is partially because the Medicaid requirements do require those sorts of assessments. But and I don't mean to say that we are not, you know, we are not screening the families and trying to screen them carefully. But we're not really doing family assessments upfront. Now, we do them before adoption to the same families. But if you get to a point where families had a child for 2 years, and then you do this very thorough assessment, and you find there's something in the background, or there's some reason that we don't feel this family should or is going to be able to provide a permanent home for the rest of the child's life, it's a little late. The child has already bonded. So we will be screening families better and really discussing the kinds of children they can and they cannot handle. So I think it will just, I think it will put us in a better position to know our families and to support them. But most states do have those support workers out there. It is a piece of the system that is missing in Alaska.
Representative Garden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm also a former foster parent, and I always felt as a foster parent that one of the best things that I could possibly do for the child in my care is mentor the birth parents.
Wonderful.
And so I really applaud the movement you're making toward it. It's a natural fit. Yes. Somebody wants to be parents, and even though there are a very few parents who intentionally harm their children and those kids should never go back to them, the vast majority are struggling with a lot of aspects of their lives, including parenting, and sometimes they just need sort of backup. They didn't have parents, as you point out, or they grew up in institutions or whatever. So I think that's a wonderful movement, and I hope that you get adequate funding and a bright future for it. One question I have about the more thorough early on licensing of foster parents. A lot of times when kids come into custody and the parents are asked, do you have a relative, and they don't, and they'll say, oh, but my friend here will take the child. And, of course, if that's a safe situation, it's far better for the child to be with mom's friend, who they know, than to go to a stranger. What kind of delay will the new background checks cause in placing a child with somebody like that?
Well, we currently place children with unlicensed what do you call them, friendly homes, in unlicensed homes. And we would like to be able to expedite those home studies to the best of our ability. Right now that's difficult with the resources that we have, but that's certainly where we want to move. We don't want to eliminate that possibility. There's some new information coming out from some of the national organizations about doing some expedited kinds of licensing for those families. On the downside of that, we participated in a federal conference call today, and there's a notice of federal rulemaking, and we believe that we may no longer be able to receive federal reimbursement in those homes if the rules go through. So but we'll do the right thing, and we'll do what we need to do, regardless of the funding.
Follow-up?
Yep.
Could you let the committee know what that pending legislation is? Because we may want to lobby our own.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I believe we may have it. Did you bring, by any chance, the roll with you? No. Okay. Then we will send that to
you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Proceed.
Okay. Where were we? believe we...
I can hopefully maybe follow up. I'm not familiar with this new licensing initiative, but there are provisions for emergency licensing, and I would hope that can still happen.
Yes.
So that the child can be in this because a non-relative can take a child without, they don't have to be foster parents. They can, if they don't want money, they could actually say, sure, the child can stay with me. I'd like to apply for a foster parenting so I can eventually get money, but we're allowed to place the child with the relative without going through the foster parents. OCS is not allowed, unless I'm mistaken, OCS is not allowed to provide with a non-relative, you know, a virtual stranger, legal stranger, unless they emergency license the home.
Right.
And hopefully this very thorough licensing check can happen at the front during this emergency licensing period. That would be the ideal, that you know as much as you know about the family from within the first, say, 90 days, and yet the child doesn't have to be in yet another home while this is taking place. Yeah. And maybe while you're figuring out maybe where we are, I can go through the legal process, unless you want to redirect us. But there's certain time periods where we go to court. Obviously, the initial hearing, come back for the adjudication hearing within 120 days, and then it's not on your list, but there's also can be a disposition hearing. And that's kind of like, well, now that the child's a child in need of aid, what do we do with the child? I mean, is the child remain out of home, and is it for up to 2 years or something less than 2 years? We can't go beyond 2 years at any at the initial time. Those two hearings, the vast majority of our cases are settled without going to court. I don't know the statistics, but usually with the other attorneys, the parents, we can work it out. The parents usually don't want their whole life's history dragged out in court. They know they've done wrong. They know they need help. They know the children shouldn't be with them while they're in treatment. You know, it's not even possible unless it's certain treatment programs. And so they'll say, yeah, I'll agree. And at that point, they'll agree not only that the child is a child in need of aid, but also that the state should have custody for that up to 2 year time period. Or if it's contested, of course the state works with the social workers, interviews witnesses, prepares their case just like you would in a criminal trial, presents witnesses. The judge makes the findings, and usually at that point it's a bifurcated two-step hearing. First you have the adjudication hearing, and then you have the disposition hearing about 2 months later, and that gives the social workers time to prepare a predisposition report that lets the court know what are the problems in the family, what's the case plan, what are the solutions, so the judge can have a background. It's kind of akin to before sentencing, there's this pre-sentence report that the probation officer does, that lets them know about that. And also, I wanted to add that at the initial hearing, in addition to the attorney for the parents being appointed, there's also the guardian ad litem that is appointed for the child. And that could be an attorney. Usually it's a non-attorney. And it's a person who's looking just what's in the best interest of the child. So, and then if it's a native case, then the tribe will often have a representative there. So you could, in theory, have five or six attorneys or guardians ad litem or tribal representatives, depending on how many children and how many fathers there are involved in the case. But it is that checks and balances where everybody's advocating their position. So the court can see the full picture. So that's within, say, 3 months of the initial of getting the case in the system in the first place, and then within 12 months of that initial custody hearing, we're back in court for the permanency hearing, which you've already heard about. And if we're going in the direction of termination, that has to happen within 6 months of the termination or within filing the petition. As a practical matter, I think it's more 3 or 4 months of filing the petition. And then the permanency hearing has to happen on an annual basis. And so on the anniversary of the child being removed from the home, I mean, hopefully you aren't going to have too many permanency hearings, because either the child's going to go back home and we're going to be done with the case, or the child's going to be adopted adopted into a home, and of course at that point the state's done with the case. But of course there are cases where you do end up with a child being in foster care for a long period of time, and the law requires you to come back to court every year to see where we're going, to make sure that this kid is moving toward a permanent solution.
You have a question, Representative?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Actually, about two unrelated items. One is the issue of establishing paternity, because over and over again, you see that cases are delayed because paternity has not definitively been established, or the state ends up paying lots of money for expedited paternity. And there was talk some years ago about having a lab, or at least the capability to do swabs in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. Has that gone through?
Through the chair, that's been a very successful, I think, everywhere. The court building's right there, and our office is there, and the paralegal in my office is trained to do the swabs. And if we're in court, we'll say to the father, come on up to our offices, and you take the Polaroid, you do the swab. She sends it into the lab, gets the results within, I don't know how long it takes, could be a month. The delays are, you have to make sure you get everybody's swab. But usually we can now establish paternity right at initially the outset of the hearing, which is a huge improvement in the system, because then not only do you know whether you have a father that's actually the father, and that may spur that person who's, before they're not really sure, but all of a sudden if they find out that's their kid, then they're really motivated to get that child back. It also opens up a whole field of relatives that you wouldn't have known about. And so social workers are also trained now to take the swabs. There was a case recently where the social worker went to the parent's door, knocked on the door, and said, "Here's my little kit." As long as everybody's in agreement with it, it's not a blood test at the hospital, sending them out. It's less complicated.
Thank you. And then the second question is aging out of the system. What services are available for children who are in custody who come of age without being able to go home and don't have permanent homes?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, this is something we're really proud of. We've made a lot of progress in the past year on this. We are assessing every child at the age of 16. They take what we call the Ansel Casey life skills test or assessment, so we can determine what skills they have that will promote independence or move them toward responsible adulthood, and what skills they lack. We then develop a plan while the child is in care. So in addition to the permanency plan that we might be working with the parent, we also now have an independent living or a transition plan with the child. Again, last year we got some new positions, and four of those positions went into the regions, one in each of our regions, to do nothing but make sure that every child has a permanency plan and that they are receiving the life skills that they need prior to aging out. At the point they age out, we can now serve children 18 to 21 years old. If they have been in foster care on or after their 16th birthday, we can serve those children with services. We also can provide some transitional housing funds, and we have educational training vouchers that have been made available to us from the federal government. UAA also has some scholarships for foster children who are aging out of the system. But I think we've brought, we had the beginnings of a program when I came back in September of 03. But now I believe we put a lot of structure around it, developed regulation and policy, and I believe our children are being served almost 100% of the time, just working on those independent living skills. So we're hoping to see fewer of them in the homeless shelters.
It's very encouraging.
So. I'd like to follow up on that. At age 16, and there's a child in a foster home. Mm-hmm. There's no place for them to go. Do they usually want to stay in the foster home, or do they want to get out on their own?
Madam Chair, some do want to just leave the day they're 18, if not sooner. So it varies. A number of these children are in relative foster homes. They will stay. The relatives will support them. If they're in a foster home, we certainly involve the foster parent in the independent living skills assessment and also in the plan. So the foster parent or the caretaker, wherever the child is a tremendous part of this planning that goes on. But a number of children have been in 5, 6, 7 foster homes, and you know, we teach our own children as they're growing up and they have one home, we teach them how to manage money or give them an allowance. These kids who have experienced 7 and 8 placements, they don't have those skills. They start over every time they go to a new home. And so it is up to us to really make sure that they have those skills. So some will, you know, will stay connected to their caretakers, and others will not. Will just walk away and never look back.
Now, can they at age 16 say, at 16 you go through the...
At 16 we begin at 16 because we know that at 18 they may want to go out on their own. So we want to make sure they have the skills to go on their own. Job search skills, resume writing skills, maybe they need to look into vocational training. At least whatever their potential is, we're going to try to find it at 16 so that at 18 they're not out on the street.
Good. And I can add that they're not just completely out at 18. They can we can keep a child up to age 20. You can keep a child now, an adult, up to age 19 without even their consent, if the court feels that's what's in their best interest. As a practical, and then after from 19 to 20, only if the child themselves consents to that being in state custody. But you'll have some kids that are still in high school and they want to finish high school, and the state's policy is if the child wants to remain in custody so that they can finish their education, I mean, the department's not going to boot them out. But even if they want out, there are provisions that if the state or the guardian ad litem truly believe it's in the child's best interest to remain in state custody, they can petition the court. As a practical matter, that doesn't happen because, you know, when you're 18, you can just leave. And if they're not willing to remain in the foster home, then what's the point? So at that point, usually that we'll seek to dismiss the case.
Now, just one follow-up on that then. How often does it happen, okay, say they're 18, they don't have the skills that they need to have to get a job or whatever, how often do they end up homeless or on the streets? Do we have any numbers on that?
Madam Chair, we don't have numbers. We know anecdotally, we hear from places like Covenant House that a number of the kids that are showing up are kids who have aged out of the system. We know that nationally it happens a lot, and I'm sure that Alaska is similar to other states. And so we've really tried to beef up the services to those children. We also have a youth advisory board, which is very exciting, alumni who have actually left our system, who we are using to advise us. and if the chair would like, we might be able to get them here to present to you. They've just been a wonderful group of kids. They, at this point, I don't think are reaching out to new kids coming in, but we hope that's part of the future plan for them. And we are receiving wonderful technical assistance and funding from, again, Casey Family Programs.
I think that'd be wonderful if they would be willing to come and answer questions. I mean, some of us would say, well, how did you feel when this happened, mm-hmm. and get some insight maybe.
Okay, they've gone into a number of groups, so we could arrange that through your aid.
That would be wonderful.
Would you like that?
Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. so I guess we're back to the pregnancy planning. Essentially, throughout the time a child is with us, we are working on permanent plans. That plan may be reunification, placement back with a relative or relative out of state. We need to go through the interstate compact For example, if there is a grandparent in another state who says, I really want to take my grandchildren, we can do that, but we are bound by the interstate compact on the placement of children. Sometimes that delays things, but it doesn't prohibit things from happening. Adoption is certainly an option, especially if the parent is not moving forward with reunification efforts. Some children in custody, of course, do remain in their own home from the beginning. Now, we don't usually see those cases staying with us for 24 months. Hopefully, they're not staying with us longer than 6 months, and our new automated system will tell us that very soon, I think. Some children have other planned permanent living arrangements, and that is long-term foster care, which we don't really like to see as a plan for a child. An end unto itself is long-term foster care is not something we like to see. But it does exist sometimes. Sometimes children are so bonded, but the foster parent for one reason or another, or the relative for one reason or another, has decided they just don't want to move forward with guardianship or adoption. So we do have a few cases where long-term foster care is the plan. Independent living or emancipation for those kids that we know are going to age out of the system, and we don't really look at that as a permanent plan for the child, but realistically as a set of services that we offer to all children who are with us. From the time they're 16 on. We know realistically some of them will age out. We also know that some of them will go back to their biological parents at 18 just because they want to. And that is their prerogative. And so again, trying to prepare them for healthy reunification even at 18 is something that we're starting to focus on. Guardianship is an option. For those who don't or choose not to go forward with adoption, or in cases where parental rights are not terminated or cannot be terminated for one reason or another, this is especially in tribal cases where termination is not culturally relevant. We encourage those providers to get guardianship, which makes the child establishes much more permanency for the child than just foster care. So that's basically kind of where we begin and end, beginning at the report of harm and taking this all the way through the achievement of the permanency plan. Through the chair. I'm sorry.
I have a question. Can you just basically tell us the difference between if it's a tribal child or if it's not? What happens that's different? And at the end, I mean, you just said that if nobody wants to step up and adopt them or what, so tell me so I have a clear picture of what do we do with the tribal child that we don't do with a quote regular one or whatever, you know, non-tribal.
Well, I hope we're looking for relatives in all of our cases. But with the tribes, there are placement preferences. There's an order of placement preference, and I'm going to get this mixed up, so I'm going to turn to either Jan or to Joanne, but the first placement preference is always with a relative in the tribe. Second is with a member of the tribe. Mm-hmm. And third, Joanne, would be
with another non-related
tribal member. And so for tribal children, that's the order we try to achieve, of placements that we try to achieve. With all of our children, we're going to try to find relative placements.
Yeah, in fact, there's a statute that said you cannot place with a non-relative unless there's a good reason for doing so. In other words, if there's a relative who's fully capable, in all cases, fully capable of caring for that child, basically you were required to place that child with that relative. I mean, that's always the first preference in all cases. But in tribal cases, they have a, you know, if not then, then they, you know, they look for the someone else who's not a relative but a member of the tribe, and then someone else who's not just another native tribe. I mean, it could be an American native. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be that the child ends up you know, in Oklahoma or something, but they're in a
native culture.
Okay.
Although that doesn't usually happen.
Representative Gardner, you had a question?
Thank you. About the distinction between adoption and guardianship, and my understanding is that guardianships can be subsidized and adoptions are generally not, and that one of the reasons for a guardianship might be a child who has special needs and is likely to require services or to have legal liabilities, maybe a child who sets fires, somebody's willing to keep but they don't want to be legally responsible, something like that. Is that not accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we can subsidize either guardianship or adoption.
So what is the distinction?
Well, one difference is that the subsidy for guardianship is state funded. The subsidy for adoption can be federally funded. Some are state funded, very few, but most are federally reimbursed. But the other difference is that in an adoption, parental rights have been terminated. With a guardianship, parental rights do not have to be terminated. And so often, my experience is that grandparents may not want to require that their child's their adult child's parental rights be terminated, yet they do want to raise the child. And so we need some assurance of permanency, that the child is not going to go back to the addicted parent. And so we would encourage the grandparent to go for guardianship, which gives them some, you know, some rights to register in school, medical treatment, marriage, Army, Navy.
Actually, it's the only thing that a guardian can't do is consent to marriage.
Marriage?
I think marriage and maybe the military, although I'm not sure about the military, and adoption. And I'm not sure about major medical treatment. You may have to go back to the parent. But it seems usually it's just the big one is marriage and adoption, of course. The child can't be adopted without the parent's approval if there's a guardianship.
And I really believe that if it's a guardian, they can grant a medical care.
Yeah,
because at the hospital,
I would think so.
I'm a nurse at the hospital in the emergency room, and if it's the guardian, that's enough.
So. Right.
Yeah. Representative Gardner.
One final question. Tribal guardianships, are they recognized, and how is a tribal guardianship different from any other guardianship?
We recognize tribal guardianship and we recognize tribal adoptions. And tribal adoptions are different in that they do not require, under the Indian Child Welfare Act, they do not require termination of parental rights. They require sanction by the tribal court. So that's not something we do a lot. We see a lot of. We are trying to promote those because we think it would, promote permanency for a number of our children. Mm-hmm. We'd like to see more of them, I think.
Any other questions?
Do all tribes have tribal courts? Or is that one of the impediments that you may have tribes that are interested but don't have the mechanism to do it?
To the chair, Representative Gardner, I'm going to turn to Joanne Givens on this. My program administrator, Joanne Givens, is here. If I could ask her to answer that question.
I can at least tell you that there's a lot of tribes that do not have tribal councils set up. Clinkin Heights and Juneau, for example, doesn't have a tribal council. So they don't have the capability of doing adoptions. I don't know the percentages, though. I don't know if anybody... Yeah, so...
We can find out.
Right.
Yeah. It's not very high.
Yeah.
It's not very high, is it, Jane? Tribal adoption?
No, and like you said, we would like to see more of them.
Thank you.
Ed? Okay. I don't know how much more. Are you done? Or
I'll just call your attention. We just have some information for you in chart forms, just in terms of the number of reports of harm, what types they are, how many we confirm and we don't confirm, the age of the children. And one of the things that we're coordinating some efforts with the department, with our Division of Public Health, we are beginning to see a preponderance of very young children coming into care. And that's disturbing. So we're going to focus some efforts, maybe develop some caseloads that are just for young children, and also do some more prevention with our...
Do you have any kind of thoughts already in mind what the outcome might be? In other words, is it the second and third generation, and that's the reason we're seeing them coming in younger, or...
Honestly, Madam Chair, honestly, I really don't know. We're just beginning to drill down with some of this. You know, our new online resources for the children of Alaska that we're calling ORCA has just gone live, and so we are hoping to really begin to look at data differently, and hopefully we'll have these answers. I don't think we really know all the reasons. I'm thinking that a lot of it is due, we're seeing more meth labs, and I know that that has something to do with the numbers of kids coming into care. Often they are young children.
I can say that that if a child's born in a hospital and there's a blood test or some indication that the child's been born addicted or at least the presence of a controlled substance, they're going to make a report of harm, and you know, more likely than not, the child will come into custody, and that may not be a drug. It could be that they know that the mother was drinking heavily. I mean, you know, in other words, if a child's born in a hospital, which the majority of children are, the hospital is going to find out this child didn't have prenatal care. This, you know, whatever the reason, the mother's not visiting the child. There's no bonding going on. The mother's going out and getting drunk and coming back. You know, they're going to find out pretty quickly that something's seriously wrong, and so, anecdotally, it could be that because, you know, if there's more drug use, it's going to show up, and the child's going to come into care earlier.
Okay. Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When things like this happen, when trends begin to occur, is there a protocol in the division to do a study? Because if, in fact, trends are beginning, that's when costs are beginning to go up, and we need to be able to figure out what's happening and actually do some preventative things to stop whatever that, especially with very young kids, as right. Well, you know. Mm-hmm. Is there a protocol?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, there's not a protocol, there's a plan. We are really just beginning to look at data to use it to actually manage and predict some trends. And part of that is we only had a limited amount of data coming out of the old system. We're beginning to look at some longitudinal data, and you know, what's happening over time, what are the experiences of children who've come into care, and then beginning to combine our data with some of the data that's coming out of public health, so that we can begin to predict some trends. We in the Office of Children's Services are beginning to develop what we call self-evaluation teams, so that in every region there's a group of community people and OCS people and other agencies, kind of a multidisciplinary group, that would look at the data in the region to try to see what's happening and to drill down, because the numbers are just numbers until you really look behind them and ask the questions, what are they showing? So we don't really have a protocol yet, but it is part of our quality assurance effort. To establish these self-evaluation teams.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Just the last chart I guess I'd like to call your attention to is the children released from custody. And you can see that almost 60% of our children do go home. These are the reasons or where children go when they are released from our custody. And so, you know, I think our record of trying to reunify is our efforts are certainly reflected in that data. And the last thing I just wanted to very briefly review, because it's a whole presentation in and of itself, is to tell those who haven't heard or who are not familiar just about the federal requirements that we need to meet. Office of Children's Services is probably one of the most federally regulated agencies you know, within the state. In January of 2000, the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level published regulations on the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and they established the Child and Family Service Reviews so that every state had an intense review that lasted at least 6 months, because you had to begin 6 months prior to them coming on site to do a very, very comprehensive self-assessment to identify your own strengths and your own weaknesses. The federal government then came on site in Alaska in June of 2002. They examined some cases, they talked with stakeholders, and they developed their own report out of that review. They then gave us back a final report, and we had to come up with a corrective action plan or a program improvement plan, which we began implementing in September of 2003. That program improvement plan binds us to certain activities, to certain improvements in the system that we need to achieve. One certainly being the visitation that Representative Gardner alluded to. That was a very big part of it. The other part is establishing our own quality assurance system so that we are looking at ourselves on a more consistent way. And we are now able to do that. We have a quality assurance unit that we've developed that goes to every office at least once a year. We hope to get to every office to be able to look at our cases in an objective way. And to determine, you know, what each regional differences are, and to establish some office program improvement plans. We have some outcomes, some aggregated outcomes that we need to meet. As I said earlier in the presentation, we really are held responsible or hold ourselves responsible for those cases that we know about. And so once we know about them and we work with a family, we work with children, we are responsible for whether or not those children are maltreated again. And so one of the measures is repeat maltreatment. The national standard is 6.1%. At the time of the federal review, Alaska was at 23.9%, way above or way below, whichever way you want to count it, the national standard. 23.4%. We are right now at 15.5%, and so we have met our goal. In our program improvement plan, I believe we committed to 22%, but we are down at 15.5%, and hopefully we'll continue to move in the right direction. For those children who come into our care and custody, we are measured on looked at that children who come into our custody are not abused while they are in our care. The national standard for that was 0.57. At the time of the review, we were at 1.91. We committed to achieving 1.7, and we are at 1.2. Again, moving in the right direction. So not quite there yet, but we have met our target, and so we will not be penalized in any way for these two outcomes. Placement stability, that is the number of times a child moves within 12 months of them coming into care. States, Alaska as well, are seeing children moving far too often. So the national standard for that was 86.7. At the time of the review, we were at 70.6. We are moving in the right direction. We are at 72.2. Length of time to achieve reunification. We are not doing quite as well as we'd like to do. At the national standard, again, the federal government expects us to achieve reunification within 12 months. National standard, 76.2. At the time of the review, we were at 58.3, and we're now at 54.1. We are not going in the right direction. And so that is something that we are trying to focus on. The length of time to adoption, the federal government asks us to try to achieve adoption for those children whose plan is adoption within 24 months. National standard at 32%. At the time of the review, we were at 21.8, and we've dropped to 18.7. Again, not going in the right direction. I think the last two are a reflection of caseload size and our ability to really work and keep those families visiting. And also, I think the court, in terms of adoption, I think the court's dockets, and I think the number of attorney generals that are out there and able to actually help us try these cases
and
have been issues.
And reunification services. That's a huge one.
Right.
Yeah.
So we are, again, into our second year of the program improvement plan. It includes, about 1,000 activities, Joanne. Do you know the total number? Right. It's a lot. It's about 1,000 activities and benchmarks that we have to meet. We are ahead of ourselves in achieving those benchmarks. And that involves things like changing policy to reflect, you know, where you want to go in terms of achieving these outcomes. If we don't achieve substantial progress, we could be penalized in terms of the amount of $40 that we would have to either pay back or that they would not give us in the future. So far, no states have been penalized. We believe we're moving along, and we think we will complete our program improvement plan, having at least achieved all of the required activities and benchmarks. So,
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any measure which reflects user satisfaction or number of complaints and the validity of the complaints? Of parents, families.
In terms of the federal government requiring that?
Or internally?
No,
I mean,
internally. Internally. If I could introduce Mike Lesba from our office, who actually handles all of those complaints, or many of those complaints, and does it quite well, if I might add. Mike is keeping some information on that, but we've developed kind of our own internal data system. Mm-hmm. We don't do a customer satisfaction survey like some divisions or departments do, but we do, as part of our quality assurance process, we do interview stakeholders. And so we get some of that feedback through the interview of stakeholders, and that includes biological parents, it includes the courts, it includes the GALs, and whatever other groups are able to be interviewed. Mm-hmm. We also now have a citizen review panel who is just in its infancy, but will hold its second town hall meeting here in Juneau Monday evening at the Egan Center, and I'd like to extend an invitation to all of you to come. I believe that went out to all legislators today. Sherry, did it go? It was yesterday.
Sorry, but it's at Centennial Hall.
What did I say? Egan Center. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well,
on Egan Rise, isn't it? I'm sorry, it's at Centennial Hall. So it's here in Juneau. They had one in Wasilla, and there will be one in Fairbanks and one in Bethel this year. And the citizen review panel is a group of citizens, some providers, some citizens from all around Alaska who will be taking public comment and public testimony on the child protection system in Alaska. They will then do an annual report, a final report with some recommendations to me and I assume to the legislature. And so that's a kind of an objective group that is taking a look-see at whether people are satisfied or not. But Mike is keeping some numbers, and at some point we'll be able to get out of that system just where the complaints are and what they're all about.
Thank you.
Okay, we let Jan Rutherdale know that we appreciate that she came. She snuck out already. And I really appreciate you coming up, Mrs. Kanai, and thank you very much. And I also want to thank my staff, Kathy Erickson, and we our secretary here with all this technology stuff over here is Ellen Nauter, and then Dan is Dan DeRue, is with the LIO. So we didn't have anybody. We had people listening in, but they were just listening. So anyway, we thank you very much for everyone coming today, and. On next Tuesday, we have we've got scheduled House Bill 82, House Bill 105, and House Bill 106. So that is what we will be looking at. And actually, the
the person for House Bill 82 is a little iffy, so we might start right in with House Bill 105 and 106. We'll see. But anyway, thank you all, and we will adjourn.
And thank you.